Wood was exhausted. For 12 days since the first Mexican troops had marched into San Antonio de Bar, there'd been a constant bombardment of one kind or another. Advances by infantry, sallies by Mexican cavalry, the digging of trenches to let soldiers move into closer range of the Alamo walls under the protection of earthworks. Seldom in that long siege had the defenders been able to sleep for any restful length of time. He guessed this was part of Santa Anna's strategy. Keep them awake, keep them off balance, wear them down before he attempted whatever his plans called for. The general expectation was that sooner or later he would stage a grand assault. The only question in most of the defenders' minds was why he had already waited so long. Isaac was hungry, too. Rations had been reduced to corn and beef, and a short supply even of that, for there were 188 men within these stone walls, but not enough food for half so many. Not since the coming of the Mexican soldiers had he eaten his fill. For the first few days, it had been obvious that new Santanista troops were arriving at regular intervals, adding to the thousands massed outside the walls throughout the town and encamped on its fringes. They had been strung out along the trail because of the sparsity of grass and decent water, as well as because of the miserable weather that had turned roads into bottomless pits of mud. Now and again, one Mexican unit or another would make an attempt at rushing the walls, only to be cut to pieces by Texan rifle fire and the lethal peppering of scrap iron and chain from the 14 artillery pieces manned within the Alamo. Each time they came, Isaac's heartbeat quickened, and when they retreated, it would be a long time slowing back to normal. If it was Santa Anna's aim to wear Isaac down, he was doing a good job of it. The Mexicans had managed, at considerable cost, to mount a number of artillery batteries beyond rifle range. These had been fired at the Texan position for days without inflicting serious damage or fatalities. The Alamo defenders had used their own cannon to good effect on occasion. But Travis, now in full command because Bowie lay half out of his head from pneumonia, had been sparing in his use of the big guns. Powder was in short supply and had to be conserved for whatever urgent need might yet come. In the early days of the siege, there had been the exhilaration of first combat to keep spirits stirred and the hope of reinforcements. Goliad was considered the most likely source. Travis had sent out couriers like Juan Seguin in the dark of night to try to bring back help. James Butler Bonham had ridden through the Mexican lines to Goliad, only to bring back word, again through Mexican lines, that Fannin had declined. Fannin said he would need all his 400 men to hold the Presidio at Goliad. At a low point in the garrison's morale, 32 men from the town of Gonzales paraded through the Mexican encampments unscathed and offered their services to the beleaguered defenders. Just 32 men when Santa Anna had thousands massed to storm these walls. But the sight of these new faces brought cheer. If they had made it through, perhaps more would be coming. That, and the fact that the Alamo had lost not a single man despite days of cannonading, lifted spirits for a time. Now, dog-tired but unable to sleep, Isaac lay with his hat for a pillow upon the bare ground and stared up at a cold, dark sky. He could smell the smoke of the Alamo's campfires, where men huddled for warmth against the night's chill, and from Mexican campfires just beyond rifle range. The odor of gunpowder was mixed in it, too. Midnight had passed. The 13th day had begun, though it would be hours yet before the sun came up. He wished for sleep, but couldn't find it. His troubled mind ran riot with 100 images, memories of the past, dreams he had once entertained, and none of which had come to pass. That they could ever come to pass for him now, he realized, was unlikely. The Mexicans had tightened their ring of steel until he knew there was no possibility of reinforcements getting in, even if any were on their way. It seemed no longer a matter of whether the Mexicans would make a frontal assault, but simply when. Sentries with spyglasses had seen troops building ladders yesterday, and there had been considerable activity in the Mexican ranks. A fierce bombardment had left a serious breach in the north wall. Then, suddenly, the firing had stopped. After all these noisy days and nights, the Santanista guns stood quiet. The eerie silence was as nerve-wracking as the cannonade. Isaac wondered if that might also be part of Santa Ana's strategy, to grind them mentally as well as physically. Again, he thought of dropping over the wall under the cover of darkness and trying to slip away alone. Earlier, he might have managed, but only one had made any move in that direction, a foreign mercenary named Rose. He was not a Texan, not even an American. He had no dedication to this fight. As for the rest, whatever the cause, valor, patriotism, defiance, or just plain inertia, nobody seemed even to consider going over the wall alone. So neither did Isaac, not seriously. Now the Mexican noose was drawn too tight. He doubted that a dog could get through that line, much less a man. To try it would almost certainly result in sudden death. But to remain here would mean no less. It might just take longer. He had seen the red flag that still flew from the church tower on the main plaza, and he had heard trumpeters play the Degeo, the call of no quarter. The garrison, if conquered, was to be put to the sword. He shuddered at the thought of cold steel. He had wondered several times if Travis might decide their situation here was impossible and try a massive breakout. Though the cost would have been high, some probably would have made it through to fight again somewhere else. But Travis had chosen to make his stand here, and the fighting men seemed to have concurred. So long as the Alamo stood, Santa Ana was delayed in making a devastating sweep across the rest of American Texas. If a Texan army was building somewhere, and he hoped to God it was, each day they delayed Santa Ana here was a day longer that army would be able to recruit volunteers and prepare itself. Isaac thought of Tennessee. His had not been an easy or a happy childhood, for his father had been lazy and cowardly, his mother embittered and mean of spirit. He had often had to fight his brothers for a fair share of anything except the work. They had always been willing to let him have his part of that, and theirs as well. Coming to Texas with Finnis and Luke, he had been sorely tempted to leave them and find his own destiny. But they had needed him, so he had remained with them to his sorrow. Now, damn them, it looked like they would have to make their own way without him after all. He thought of Annie Lewis. He knew that from the beginning she had been a forlorn hope. The Lewises might have killed rather than let a Blackwood join the family, Michael especially. Of all the Lewises, Michael had more cause than any to hate the entire Blackwood clan. Isaac had always understood that, and he'd never really blamed Michael for his feelings, hard as they might have been on Isaac himself. But he had wanted Annie as he had never wanted a woman before. To see her hand in hand with another man had brought a shattering end to a desperate dream. First and last, he thought of the boy Cyrus. It had taken him a long time to win any affection from the youngster, for real affection was a rare commodity in the Blackwood family. Cyrus certainly had inherited none from Finnis, if indeed Finnis was his father. It was plausible that the boy was Isaac's. Slow-minded Nellie had not been particular with whom she shared a bed. As the years went on, Finnis's meanness had turned the boy more and more toward Isaac, who offered him shelter, who gave him guidance and understanding and love. What would become of little Cyrus now? In the gloom, Isaac could see Alessandro Zaragoza dozing with a rifle across his lap, a sword at his side. At least Zaragoza had been able to talk to his son, to hug him tightly, before he turned to face whatever fate awaited him within these walls. Isaac envied him that. He wished he could have Cyrus here now, just for a minute. He wished he could say to him things he had said in his mind 100 times, but had never brought himself to speak aloud.
I thought I had all the time in the world.
He measured time now in hours, in minutes.
On your feet, boys! They're coming!
The trumpet commanded the Mexican troops to charge. Isaac hurried to his post. Under the dark sky, he could make out vague shapes moving across the opening. They looked like tall grass waving in a night wind. But these were men carrying muskets and bayonets. He saw the bobbing motion of ladders as soldiers came running, carrying them in the hope of scaling the high walls. Mexicans were converging on every side. Isaac fired into that surging mass, knowing he could not miss, that he had to have brought down a man. But he could not know which, for they were falling like leaves as far as he could see in the faint light of early morning. Ladders meant for scaling the walls never reached that far, falling as those who carried them fell. The charge broke off. The soldiers turned and ran for their lives. Those who had ladders dropped them. In the bright light that followed a cannon's blast, Isaac saw bodies scattered near the wall and in the field beyond it, some still, some yet struggling against death. There was death atop the wall, too. Texans had been killed by musketry in that first brave assault, but the carnage had been far greater among the Mexicans because they had had to cross that opening into a blazing hell. Isaac reloaded his rifle before he took time to try to recover his breath. His heart was hammering, his blood running hot. His hands trembled so that he lost a little of the powder. He had to get control. There was not so much powder that they could afford any waste. He looked around, remembering that just before the assault, he had seen Zaragoza sleeping nearby. He saw him now, his face bloodied by a musket ball that had grazed his cheek. But Zaragoza was on his feet. Isaac went to him.
You gonna be all right?
Always as a soldier, I wished for rifles that would shoot straighter. Now I am glad we never got them.
We sure as hell beat them off. Maybe they won't be coming again.
I think we did not kill Santa Ana. They will come again.
They did, just at dawn. The soldiers came running, carrying fresh ladders, picking up those that had fallen before. The Texan rifles blazed again, and the cannon belched death. Some of the ladders made it as far as the walls, but no soldiers managed to climb one. The second wave recoiled and fell back. So did Isaac, feeling that he had no strength left to meet another charge. But he found that he did, for shortly the Mexicans rallied and came again. This time there were more soldiers, and in the dawn's light they could finally see enough to take aim at the defenders. Despite the Texan fire, despite its deadly impact, there were more soldiers than defender rifles or cannons. For each who fell, 10 came behind, and several thousand feet pounded like thunder across the deadly field. This time, the ladders made it to the wall. They slammed against it, and soldiers scrambled up to be met by bullets, by rifle butts, by sharp knives patterned after the one carried by Jim Bowie. In the moment that they reached the top of the ladder and grabbed for something to hold on to pull themselves up, they were vulnerable. Isaac did not have time to reload. He brought his rifle around and jabbed the butt end of it against a head. Then he shoved the ladder with his foot. It went crashing down. Powder smoke choked him, but he hardly noticed, for his blood was at the boil. He reloaded his rifle. The defenders along the wall were spread too thin to withstand the hordes rushing over. Isaac felt them coming past him in waves. He no longer had time to reload the rifle. He found himself standing back to back with Alessandro Zaragoza, who fought now with his sword. For a moment, he glanced around and his gaze met Zaragoza's. He saw a wild exhilaration in the man's black eyes. In these last moments, Zaragoza was a soldier again, fighting like a soldier to his final breath. Isaac slashed his rifle across the head of a man who came charging at him with a bayonet. For a second or two, he stood there with the useless broken rifle in his hands, then flung it away and grabbed a knife from his belt. He saw Zaragoza take a bayonet through his heart. Zaragoza fell back against Isaac, knocking him off balance. Isaac surged forward at two soldiers who charged him. He plunged the knife to the hilt into one, then saw the other raise his musket. He felt the ball drive into his chest with the force of a sledgehammer. He was numb, half blinded by the fire. He fought for breath but could draw none. He saw the flash of bayonets as two more soldiers came at him. He dreaded the steel, but he did not feel it now. He felt nothing except the sensation of floating slowly to the floor. The last thing he heard was his own voice.
Annie. Cyrus.
Lieutenant Diaz knew it was more than the saber slash across his shoulder that made him feel ill. He was appalled at the slaughter before him in the wide plaza between the Alamo's walls. The dead and dying lay often in heaps, like rag dolls carelessly flung about by thoughtless children. No man could walk across the ground from the wall to the chapel entrance without stepping in pools of blood. Mexican soldiers and Texan defenders were intermingled in death. He could hear an occasional shot as a wounded Texan was given the coup de grace, and he saw troopers in a blood frenzy bayoneting bodies to make certain. El Presidente had ordered that not one male defender be left alive. So far as Diaz could tell, every one of them had fought until he died or was so badly wounded he could no longer raise an arm in defiance.
Hombres muy valientes.
Valiant men, all of them, on both sides. After the heat and fury of the battle, the relative calm gave him time to feel the chill of an early March morning. He could see his breath in the air and wished for a coat or a blanket. Santa Anna had commanded that no man wear a cloak or carry a blanket or anything else that would hamper movement. Diaz could feel the blood still trickling from the wound, and he gripped it with his hand, hoping he might stop the bleeding. He had no idea when he might receive medical attention. So many needed it worse than he. The firing stopped at last, and the bayoneting. Some of the soldiers began searching the clothing of the dead, looking for money or knives or any other treasure that might suit their fancy. Diaz watched with mixed feelings. The men had fought well, and he supposed they deserved anything they found. But the Texans had amazed him with the ferocity of their defense. He had half expected that when they saw the hopelessness of their plight, those who had survived to that point would try to surrender and beg for mercy. It had not happened. He had not seen a man who looked as if he even considered it. Of course, they had seen the red flag and had heard the degeo. They knew they were doomed to die. Santa Anna had made it plain that he took no prisoners. To rob these men now seemed a sacrilege, but he made no move to stop it. He had no energy left, and those who rifled pockets probably wouldn't listen to him anyway. Diaz looked to the sound of the commotion. El Presidente had entered the plaza, flanked by several of his subordinates. He had watched the battle from a safe distance, beyond the range of the Texan rifles. Now he came to taste the fruits of his victory. Diaz pushed painfully to his feet and tried to salute, but his wound prevented him from raising his arm that high. Santa Anna gave him only the briefest of glances anyway. This was the nearest Diaz had ever been to the general. He was, after all, merely a lieutenant, a common soldier who had worked his way up from private to corporal to sergeant and finally to a commission. Santa Anna had lieutenants by the hundreds.
We've gained the prize, Excellency, but the cost has been terrible. See how many of our soldiers have died?
Santa Anna betrayed no regret.
It gave meaning to their lives. It is a soldier's destiny to die in battle. These, at least, were privileged to die for Santa Anna and for Mexico.
He turned to a nervous civilian Diaz recognized as the mayor of San Antonio. It was obvious that the poor man had no wish to be here, and that he had come only at Santa Anna's command.
I want you to find for me the bodies of Travis and Bowie and Crockett. I want to see them for myself.
What shall we do with so many dead, Excellency?
We will bury our own with honor. As for the enemy, we will burn them. Send a detail into the town and pick up as many able-bodied men as you can find. Compel them to bring wood to make the fire.
One officer left immediately to carry out that order. Another gathered soldiers and had them begin picking up the bodies. The Mexican dead were handled with a certain reverence and care. The Texans were brought to a central place and carelessly flung into a heap. Diaz did not want to look at them, but he couldn't help himself. He had seen a few Mexicans among the defenders fighting side by side with the Americanos. He wondered if there were any he had known during his service in the San Antonio garrison. He was standing there when they brought down the body of Alessandro Zaragoza from the narrow walkway atop the wall. The men were about to fling it on top of the others.
Stop! I know that man! Put him down here, with respect!
The soldiers looked at him with surprise, as if he had ordered them to spit upon the flag, but they complied. Diaz knelt before his one-time commander and tried to straighten the dirty, blood-stained coat. Bloody slits showed where bayonets had pierced Zaragoza's chest. The eyes were open. He tried to close them with his fingers, but it was already too late. He supposed it did not matter. Zaragoza had already looked upon his lord, the lord of them all.
Why? Why were you here? Did you not know that the fight was hopeless from the start? Why were you not at your farm? Your family around you. Now a widow weeps for you, and your children cry for their father.
As Santa Anna had commanded, men from the town came under guard, bringing posts and fence rails and other wood for fuel. The president himself saw to the stacking of the bodies, with layers of timber between them for the burning. The men from the town stared ashen-faced at the horror of the Alamo Plaza. Diaz felt his heart quicken as he recognized one of them, not quite a man, a boy, really.
Manuel! Manuel Zaragoza!
The boy turned at his call. His eyes widened at the sight of Diaz. Then his gaze fell to the man who lay at Diaz's feet.
Papa?
He fell to his knees at his father's side. Soldiers came to pick up Zaragoza's body.
Leave it.
We have our orders, sir.
And I have given you another. You will not burn this man.
Santa Anna had heard the commotion and strode over to see what the dispute was about. It was the first time he had ever had reason to speak to Diaz.
What is the trouble here?
I respectfully ask an exception for this man, sir. He has been a good soldier for Mexico. He fought against the Spanish. He was for a long time my commander. His boy here is his son. I ask permission for the boy to take him home to his family.
Manuel turned a grief-stricken face up to Santa Anna in silent supplication.
He was one of the enemy, was he not? He fought at the side of the Americanos?
I would ask that you take into account all that he has done for his country. Please, Excellency.
He was a traitor. Burn him!
No! Please!
Soldiers grabbed Manuel roughly and pulled him back.
No, Papa! Stop it! Let go of me! You cannot do this! Stop it! No!
Santa Anna glared at Diaz.
Do you not have duties to perform? Be about them, or I shall have you court-martialed. I have no use for an officer who speaks for traitors.
The soldiers picked up Zaragoza's body and put it on the pyre with the others. His son, Manuel, stood where he was being held, staring in mute shock. Anger smoldering in his heart, Diaz watched El Presidente walk away with his retinue about him. He had served Santa Anna with all the dedication and zeal a common soldier could muster. He had believed in him as the savior of Mexico. Now, his mouth filled with the bitter taste of disillusionment, he detested him as he had detested few men in his life. He moved toward Manuel and put his good hand on the boy's shoulder.
Come, Manuel. I will see you home.
Manuel pulled away from him and stepped back. His dark eyes crackled with fury.
Stop! You helped kill him. I can get home by myself.
Manuel, I tried.
No! If ever I see you again, I hope it is over the sights of my rifle.
Manuel turned and trudged toward the wooden bridge and the road that led to town. Diaz watched him with burning eyes. The shoulder ached, and he brought his hand up to it again. He wondered why he had ever chosen to become a soldier. The event would become known in Texas history as the Runaway Scrape, the flight of the Texan settlers to escape the wrath of Santa Anna and his advancing armies. It began as word spread across the land that Travis and his men had been annihilated within the blood-drenched walls of the Alamo. Indeed, Santa Anna purposely set the retreat in motion to clear as many people as possible from the path of his troops. When the guns at the Alamo fell silent, Mrs. Almiron Dickinson was found with a handful of Mexican women huddled in terror in one of the old chapel's rooms. He sent the newly widowed woman and her baby forth to carry the news to the town of Gonzales. Sure, the terrible story she told would throw Texas into panic and simplify his sweep across the rebellious colonies. The civilian evacuation became a stampede after news of the horror at Goliad. There, the indecisive Fannin, who had declined to reinforce Travis at the Alamo, delayed a retreat ordered by Sam Houston until it was too late. He surrendered his entire force to Mexican troops under General Jose Urrea, who promised with good intentions that they would be granted mercy as prisoners of war and repatriated to the United States. Santa Anna coldly countermanded Urrea and ordered the captives executed. To the disgust and shame of Urrea, an honorable man, most of 400 men were marched out of the old Goliad fort on Palm Sunday, lined up and shot by firing squads. Certain now that Santa Anna meant to slaughter every American who fell into his hands, settler families began a desperate run for safety across the Sabine River. Sam Houston himself sent riders out to warn them and hurry them along. A great many of their menfolk rallied to Houston's army, driven by a cold fury over the Alamo and Goliad, and hoping, at the least, to fight a delaying action that would allow their families time to escape. Annie Lewis was in her cabin alone when young Mordecai came galloping over from the direction of Andrew and Petra's, his face aflush with excitement. He rushed up to the dog run, where Annie stood in the cold wind, wiping her hands on a cotton apron.
And Annie, we've got to hitch up the wagon and get away from here quick. Santa Anna's coming. He could be here any time.
How do you know?
A rider just came by. Sam Houston sent him. Mama said for me to help you. Aunt Petra will be ready for us by the time we get there.
In the back of her mind, Annie had known all along that this might happen, but she had refused to acknowledge it by word or deed.
I wish James was here.
But neither James nor Andrew had been heard from since they'd ridden away in different directions to search for Michael. She pointed toward the river.
You'll have to go fetch the mules. Last time I saw them, they were grazing down that way.
As Mordecai reined his horse around the cabin and struck a long trot toward the river, she turned back into the kitchen, trying to decide what to take. They couldn't put a lot in the wagon, not have room for her and Petra's children. Food, of course. Cornmeal, what little there was, some hog lard, a couple of slabs of bacon, a cured ham, and a skillet and a pot to cook in. Blankets, a few extra clothes because the late March weather remained wet and cold, and corn to feed the mules. She quickly began gathering these things and carrying them out to the wagon. She had most of them secured by the time Mordecai returned, driving a pair of mules Baptiste Villeray had left behind with the wagon. The wise old Frenchman had feared all along that this situation might arise. He had left the Lewis families prepared as well as he could. When they had hitched the mules, she took a long look at the cabin that had become home. Tears stung her eyes as she realized she might not see it again. She started to climb up into the wagon, then stepped back.
We better be hurrying.
In a minute.
She went back into her bedroom. She glanced for a moment at the bed, remembering Sly Shipman. She thought she should curse his memory, but at this moment she could only take warmth and comfort from it. She dug into a box and came up with several of her drawings tied together with a black ribbon. They were of family members back home in Tennessee, of her mother. There were sketches of Michael and Andrew and James, and there was one of Shipman. If the Mexicans came, they would probably burn the cabin and everything in it. She would not give them the chance to destroy these. She carried them to the wagon and stuck them between the stacked blankets. She found that Mordecai had pulled the wagon sheet up over the hoops and secured it, for the sky was leaden and promised more rain. There had already been more than enough. The wheels pulled heavily in the mud as Annie flipped the reins to start them moving. Mordecai rode close beside her on his dun horse. The second wagon was at Cousin Frank's place, for Frank was the only grown man here to supervise the family's flight to Sanctuary. It had been agreed beforehand that if evacuation became necessary, this wagon would carry Annie and Petra and Petra's family. Frank would take his own family and that of Marie.
Thank God Frank stayed to help.
I'm afraid Uncle Frank can't help us much. He's flat on his back with pneumonia.
What?
He went out to try to get some fresh meat and got caught in the cold rain. He was running an awful fever when I went by there a while ago. But Aunt Hope and her boys said they'd get the wagon loaded and meet us at Mama's.
Annie felt that clutch at her throat again. For a moment, she almost gave in to despair. The only man they had, helpless. Four women, their children, two wagons, and all those long, muddy miles to be traveled. Only God knew how close the Mexican soldiers might be. She found the boy looking at her with eyes that showed concern, but also determination. The same determination she had seen many times in the blue eyes of the Lewis men. At this moment, Mordecai looked much like Michael had looked at his age. Michael had been able to take care of himself from the time he was old enough to lift a rifle to his shoulder and hold its heavy barrel steady. If Frank Lewis was helpless, Mordecai was not. Neither was Annie Lewis. Nor would the other women be. She straightened her back and shoulders.
Let's be about our work, Mordecai.
As promised, Petra was ready when Annie got to her cabin. If Petra felt any fear, she didn't show it. She was grimly businesslike as she put more blankets, a few clothes, and a little more food into the wagon to add to what Annie had brought. The wagon was well loaded now. The weight of its new passengers forced the wheels to bite deeper into the mud. It tugged at the wheels, slowed their turning, and forced the team to strain harder. Mordecai stayed abreast of the mules.
Come on, boys! Ha! Ha!
Annie saw that he looked back over his shoulder frequently. She knew he was watching for pursuit. Like Petra, any fear he might have felt was carefully concealed. By years, he might still be a boy, but this day he was doing a man's part. Annie glowed with pride for her nephew. She only wished Michael could know. They did not have to go all the way to Marie's cabin. Annie saw the second wagon already on its way, angling across to meet them. Like Annie's, its hoops were covered by canvas. Marie had the reins. Frank's wife, Hope, sat beside Marie. Both women looked calm.
Where's Frank?
Hope pointed back over her shoulder.
We made him a pallet in the bed of the wagon. He's running a terrible fever.
I think he doesn't even know what is happening. It is up to us women. We must get by without a man's help.
Annie pointed toward Mordecai.
We've got a man.
They had to stop to rest the animals after a while, for the heavy mud made the wagons hard to pull. A reluctant thought came to Annie.
What about the Blackwoods?
They have a wagon. Well, they did. If Finnis has not sold it for whiskey money.
But do you suppose they got the word? They live back in the timber. The messengers might have missed them.
Annie thought mainly of the boy, Cyrus, who had come with Isaac more than once to visit her. There was no way to know for certain, but she feared Isaac was dead. The last she had heard of him, through James, he had remained in San Antonio de Bar. The boy and the rest of the family had no one to defend them now except Finnis and Luke. Those two were hopelessly incompetent.
What do you want to do?
Annie looked down toward the river.
We've got to cross it somewhere anyhow. I say we go down to the ford yonder, then over to the Blackwoods. It isn't much out of our way.
Marie frowned and looked back to the west from where the Mexicans would likely come. The horizon was clear.
Michael would not like it. But Michael is not here. Let's be about it.
The river's current was strong. Annie and Marie doubled the two teams, taking one wagon across, then the other, while Mordecai rode close by, ready to take hold if an emergency arose. Annie was a little apprehensive about the mules. Water sometimes threw a scare into them. She kept a firm hand on the lines until the crossing had safely been made. She lifted a corner of the wagon sheet and looked in at Cousin Frank, lying on a folded blanket, trying to fight his way out from under another blanket firmly tucked around him.
I've got no business lying flat on my back. I promised I'd get you womenfolk and youngins to safe ground.
Annie felt his forehead and found it hot.
If you get up now, you're liable to die just when we need you the most. Lie still. Us womenfolk are doing just fine. Us and Mordecai.
She was not surprised at what they found when they reached the Blackwood place. Finnis was stomping around the poor cabin, showing about as much sense as a chicken with its head cut off.
Hurry up, Nellie, and get that wagon loaded. Them Mexicans are liable to be here any minute.
Annie did not climb down from the wagon.
So you've heard?
Luke came hurrying out of the house, his arms laden with blankets. He stumbled and went sprawling, spilling everything out. He trampled half the blankets into the mud while he picked up the rest, letting them fall out of their folds and trail on the ground. He heaved them into the back of the wagon without any attention to the way they landed.
Oh my God, Luke! I swear you've got to be about the dumbest thing I ever saw!
Shut up, you fat
old... Where's the boy, Cyrus?
Annie saw the boy coming out of the cabin dragging a sack of cornmeal too heavy for him to carry. Annie caught Mordecai's eye and pointed. Mordecai jumped down from his dun horse and went to the boy's aid.
We lost Isaac! God help us, we lost Isaac! Them Mexicans massacred him with all them others at the Alamo!
Annie saw that the boy Cyrus was crying. She climbed down from the wagon and took him into her arms. Annie could only hold him. She knew nothing to say that would lessen the loss. The Blackwoods had not even begun hitching up their team of mules. Without being told, Mordecai took that chore upon himself. He had them harnessed and ready for the wagon.
It's the Mexicans! They're on us!
Finis was pointing toward the trail from which the Lewis wagons had come. Annie blinked, trying to clear her eyes. She saw three horsemen. At the distance, it was impossible to tell anything about them.
They'll kill us, Luke! They'll kill both of us!
Finis jerked the long lines from Mordecai's hands, threw the collar off one of the mules, and jumped up onto its back.
Finis, what are you fixing to do?
They won't kill women and children, but they'll butcher us men. Get on that mule, Luke. We gotta get out of here.
Luke had always done whatever Finis told him. He swung onto the second mule without even taking the collar off.
Finis!
Finis kicked his mule in the belly and set off in a run, showering mud behind him. Luke followed, taking much of the mud.
You cowardly sons of bitches, you come back here! God damn you to hell, Finis Blackwood!
Mordecai stared at her in amazement. Nellie stood looking after her fleeing husband and brother-in-law.
Well, don't that just be all?
Annie was about to tell Mordecai that he had better run too, for he was old enough that the Mexicans might regard him as a man and kill him. But the approaching riders were closer now. To her relief, she saw that they wore no uniforms. They were American. One of them had a familiar way of sitting in the saddle. She blinked hard, trying to clear the tears that persisted in burning her eyes.
Marie, tell me I'm right. Tell me if that...
It is. It's Sly Shipman.
Annie hurried around the wagon, intending to run and meet them. But she stopped, remembering the hurt, remembering the day he had left her to ride back toward Natchitoches with Baptiste. She had wanted to beg him to stay, but pride had not let her. If he didn't think enough of her to remain of his own volition, she didn't need him, she had thought. Pride stopped her now from running to him. She retreated back around the wagon.
Is everybody here? Is everybody all right?
We are fine so far.
Where's your menfolk?
Frank is in the wagon, very sick. The rest rode off to the war. We don't know where they are.
I don't see Annie. What about Annie?
Marie did not reply except to tilt her head in Annie's direction. Shipman brought his horse around the rear of the wagon where Annie stood.
Annie?
She wanted to go to him, but would not. She wanted to tell him she had sorely missed him, but she would not. Instead, she looked at him in silence.
As soon as I heard what happened to Goliath, I came running to help you. Went to your cabin, saw your tracks, and followed them here.
What for? We've gotten along real good without you.
Well, maybe I shouldn't have even come then. Maybe I ought to have just stayed back yonder in Louisiana.
Maybe you should have.
They stared at one another from three full paces apart. She ached to rush to him, to have him enfold her in his arms, but that stubborn Lewis pride held her where she stood. She looked into his eyes and saw there not anger, but anxiety, hurt. She sensed that he wanted to apologize, but there was pride in the Shipman blood, too.
You look to me like you put on a little weight.
Shipman had several days' growth of whiskers to show for his long ride getting here.
You don't look all that good yourself.
Marie leaned down from her place on the wagon seat.
We have all the children that we can handle. We do not need you two to act as if you are 6 years old. You both want to hug each other, so do it! And let us leave this place before the soldiers come.
Tears blinded Annie as she stepped forward. Sly Shipman grabbed her into his arms and crushed half the breath out of her.
Oh, Annie Lewis.
I was scared to death I wouldn't find you at all.
It began to rain. Annie loosened her hold on Chipman and looked up, drops pelting her face.
Just what we needed with these wagons to move. More water and more mud.
It'll slow Santa Ana as much as it slows us.
Still holding Annie by the hand, he turned toward Nellie Blackwood and her children.
Let's get these folks on the wagons and get moving. It's a long ways to the Sabine.
They pulled out, leaving the Blackwood wagon standing in a driving rain. James Lewis had tried to count the days, but had lost track, walking in a northeasterly direction through a part of Texas he'd never seen before. He tried at first to move only at night, but he found it painfully difficult making his way afoot through the rough chaparral in darkness. Twice he wandered into thick stands of prickly pear cactus and found himself entrapped. No matter which way he turned, he drove the thorns into his legs until he had to give up, sit on the ground, and wait for dawn to let him pick his way through. With his fingers and his knife, he pulled out those thorns he could get hold of. The rest would remain until they festered and came out of their own accord. He knew he ran considerable risk moving in daylight, so he stayed constantly alert for a sign of riders. Several times he thought he saw them, and he dropped flat upon the ground, heedless of the stickers and thorns. Once they turned out to be deer, warily picking their way along, browsing on the low-growing brush, then bounding away when they saw him. Once they turned out to be wild horses, drifting toward water. More often, what he thought was riders turned out to be his imagination. The wild horses, at least, led him to water. Having a rifle allowed him to kill game. Otherwise, he might have starved or been reduced to trying to subsist on roasted prickly pear pads, which he had heard was possible. The first time, hungry almost to the point of delirium, he managed to shoot a deer. Fearing that his shot might be heard by Mexicans or perhaps roving hostile Indians, he laid low for an hour, hardly daring to raise his head above the level of the low chaparral until he was satisfied that nobody was coming in response to the shot. He built a small fire, but gave the first piece of venison time for no more than a little scorching on the surface. He devoured it with the ferocity of a half-starved wolf. He carried along all the meat he could, eating from it for days until it began to spoil. Some of the pear thorns became infected, and he began running a fever. He had heard of people using a prickly pear poultice to draw away infection. He singed the thorns from several pear pads, split them open lengthwise, and applied them to the festering places. He had to lie up a couple of days until the fever broke and the healing began. In all that time, he kept wishing he had a coat to shield him from the raw and chilling wind. He had left his tied to his saddle. He tried tanning the deer hide enough to use, but failed for lack of time or proper materials. He had to discard it when it stiffened and the stench became too much to bear. He had no idea what was happening elsewhere. He had seen enough soldiers earlier to convince him that Santa Ana's invasion had been no flight of fancy, no figment of imagination by those who seemed always ready to surrender to blind fear. He sensed that the patrols he had seen were but the outriders flanking an army. By now, that army had had time to reach San Antonio and there challenge the Texans barricaded in the old mission grounds. He could only guess what the outcome had been. Were he Santa Ana, he would probably leave enough men there to encircle the mission and besiege the defenders until they were starved into submission, while he took his main force and proceeded across the colonies, sweeping everything before him as he marched. If that were Santa Ana's strategy, he could well have traversed the whole of American Texas by now. He could have overrun Austin's colony, including the Lewis Farms, and perhaps have his victorious army encamped on the west bank of the Sabine, daring a return by any of the survivors who had fled to sanctuary on the Louisiana side. James lay awake nights, wondering what had become of Annie, of Marie and Petra, and Hope and the children. Surely Cousin Frank would not have let the Mexicans overtake them. For all his breezy outlook on life, Frank was serious when he had to be. Looking back, James was ashamed of his own occasional irresponsibility on the long trek west from Tennessee. Had it not been for Frank imposing a gentle but firm hand at times, they might never have made it into Texas. Frank could laugh easily, but that laugh could quickly give way when something else was called for. He wondered, too, about Andrew. Perhaps he had returned home when he became convinced he would not find Michael. Or perhaps he had become embroiled in some battle with the Mexican forces and was unable to return home. It could even be that Andrew had joined Michael among the lost, that James was the only surviving Lewis brother in Texas. Even he was still a long way from home. Gradually, the land changed. It became less of a desert and more benign, like the land he knew along the Colorado. At first, he found none of it that showed any sign it had ever been inhabited, except for traces of old Indian camps along an occasional creek or stream. One day, just at dusk, he came across a log cabin much like his own. It appeared to have been abandoned hastily. The door was hanging open. Warily, his rifle primed and ready, he worked his way to it, then stepped through the door. James found a cured ham hanging from the ceiling. The people who had fled this cabin had not taken everything with them. If they had left food, perhaps he might find better clothes than the brush-torn rags that hung from him in ribbons. He searched the cabin, but found nothing he could use except an old blanket. At least that would give him some protection from the cold. He wrapped it around his shoulders as he had seen the Mexicans wrap a serape. He built a small fire in the fireplace and cooked up some of the ham and some Johnny cake from a bit of cornmeal he found. He would have given his right arm for coffee, a piece out of the arm anyway, but there was none. If these people had even had any, they had taken it with them. If they were like the Lewises, coffee was a luxury not lightly come by and not often used except for special occasions, like Sunday gatherings of all the families, and not always then. He ate the best meal he'd enjoyed in weeks, then spread the blanket on a bed made of posts and a strip of rawhide laced back and forth, front to back and side to side. There was a risk that Mexican soldiers could find him, but he had been running that risk for weeks, laboring his way across the country a few miles a day. It appeared unlikely that soldiers had been here, or he would not have found any food in the cabin, or the blanket. More than likely, he would have found no cabin, only charred ruins. The night brought its damp chill, but he wrapped himself in the blanket and slept his best sleep in weeks. He awakened in the morning's light, not remembering for a moment where he was.
A rooster.
Where there was a rooster, there ought to be hens, and where there were hens, there ought to be eggs. He had not eaten an egg since he had left home. He stepped outside, able now to see the place much more clearly than he had at dusk. To his surprise, he saw a sorrel horse standing by a crude set of pole pens, reaching its head across the top rail. He pulled back quickly against the cabin, wondering who the rider was. Then he saw that the horse wore no saddle, no bridle. It had wandered here, or more likely, it belonged here. Probably the people who owned this cabin had left in a big hurry. The horse had been off grazing somewhere, and they'd been afraid to take the time to go looking for it. James walked out slowly and carefully, making no sudden move that might startle the horse and cause it to run. It pricked up its ears and watched his approach. It turned once as if to move away.
Gentle now, boy. Be gentle and stand there. I ain't fixing to do you no harm. Just stand there, feller.
James picked up a makeshift rawhide rope from off the fence and held it behind his back with his left hand, raising his right hand carefully. The sorrel's hide rippled as James cautiously touched the neck, and the horse backed off half a step. James ran his hand gently up into its mane and took a firm hold, then brought the rope up and laid it across the animal's neck, forming a handheld loop around the throat. When the horse accepted that, James slipped the mane loop over his head. Now, unless it took a sudden fright and jerked away, breaking the rawhide, the horse was caught. James could tell right away that it was well broken and dependent upon a kind human hand. He rubbed it along the neck, and the horse nuzzled him. It followed him as he laid the gate open and walked into the pen. Beside a rough lean-to shed, James found a corn crib. He shelled several ears into a trough and watched the horse take it eagerly.
Old boy, folks that left you here must have figured this wasn't any safe place to stay.
I reckon they knew the situation a lot better than I do. So we're fixing to do what they did. We're going.
He formed the rawhide into a makeshift hackamore, as he had seen Mexican horsemen do. He led the horse to the cabin, picking up the blanket, the ham, and his rifle. He forgot about the eggs. James jumped up onto the horse's bare back. He realized that technically he was guilty of horse theft, but under the circumstances, nobody was likely to object. The horse's owners had abandoned it to the Mexicans, who would probably have taken it anyway had they found it. Having the animal would allow him to make much faster progress. He kept moving in the same northeasterly direction he had followed during the many days of his long walk. Sooner or later, he must come to the Colorado River. There should be no mistaking it when he did. He knew it from well west of the farm, most of the way down to its mouth at the coast. North of the Colorado lay the Brazos, and eastward along the Brazos, San Felipe. The sorrel horse's ears warned him in time to keep him from riding headlong into a large group of Mexican infantry marching in an easterly direction. He pulled the horse up under some huge live oak trees and dismounted to be harder to see. He was glad the soldiers were not cavalry, for he might have found himself in a horse race. He had no idea how well the sorrel could run. He had had no reason to try him. He could at least outrun the infantry. They failed to see him, so he didn't have to put the sorrel to the test. He gave the infantry plenty of time to pass out of sight before he rode across their back trail. Though the country was beginning to look more and more like the area he knew best, he was not familiar with the dim road the soldiers followed. He didn't tarry long to study it. He sensed the Colorado River before he reached it. He realized as soon as he saw the trees and crossed a familiar road that he had come in west of home. The road showed recent hoof prints. There was no way of telling whether the riders had been Texan or Mexican soldiers, so he moved on down the river and rode where he could quickly pull into the cover of the timber if need be. He had the blanket wrapped around his shoulders against a light, cold rain. He kept the rifle across his lap and primed, the lock dry beneath the blanket. In this kind of weather, flintlocks often failed because the powder became damp. His pulse quickened as familiar landmarks told him he was nearing his farm. He considered it unlikely that he would find any of the family there. Surely by now, Frank had evacuated them to safer ground. James moved up over a rise and saw his cabin below, and Andrew's well beyond it. Over to his right was Frank's. Michael's lay out of sight beyond a hill. He had half expected to find all of them in ashes, for he had come across several that had been burned, either by the settlers to deprive the soldiers their use, or by the soldiers to leave the settlers nothing to come home to. He was gratified to see that the Lewis cabins remained intact. He remained in the edge of the timber, caution overriding his eagerness to get home. He watched the house a while before he risked riding up to it. He found some corn at the shed and left the horse in the pen, its nose stuck deep into the feed trough. He saw a pair of twin ruts cut deeply into the mud and not yet completely washed away, showing where the wagon had moved. On harder ground a little farther out, he found no more trace. Rains had washed away all sign. He walked up to the cabin, pushing the kitchen door open and stepping quickly inside as he had done at the first one he had come to. The place was empty. He felt of the ashes in the fireplace. They were, as he expected, dead and cold. By the look of things, Annie had been gone for some time, possibly several days. He crossed the dog run to his own room. There he found an old homespun shirt and a pair of trousers. He also found a threadbare coat he had once intended to throw away, but had decided to save for cutting logs and other rough work of the kind. He looked into a cracked mirror at his bearded face. In a peaceful time, he would have shaved, but such a luxury held no interest for him now. Anyway, the whiskers helped protect his face from the cold and the wind. He didn't stay long at his cabin, but picked up the trail that led toward San Felipe. In low spots, he saw enough deeply cut ruts to indicate that this was the direction Annie had taken with her wagon. He found where a second wagon had joined from the direction of Michael's place. He was a little surprised to find indications that they had crossed over the river at the nearest ford and moved toward the Blackwood farm. What had possessed them to go by the Blackwoods, he couldn't even guess. But he followed, putting the sorrel into a stiff trot. He found the Blackwoods' abandoned wagon standing in front of their cabin, the wagon sheet loose and flapping in the wind. The wagon had been loaded with goods for departure, then abandoned. That worried James more than a little. He wondered what could have spooked them. He made a quick search of the Blackwood shed and found there two saddles which had belonged to Finnis and Luke. He couldn't imagine why they'd not taken them. He was tired of riding bareback. He picked the strongest looking of the two saddles and put them on the sorrel. He might argue it out with Finnis when and if he ever saw the shiftless reprobate again. Given a good scare, Finnis could already be halfway back to Tennessee. As he moved eastward, he lost the tracks of the two wagons because other wagons and carts had pulled into the same trail. Their wheels had sunk deeply into the soft mud, leaving a trace that would probably remain at least into the dry months of summer before they finally filled with dirt and covered with grass. The sorrel horse swung its head to the right, its ears pointed forward. James saw a horse moving as fast as its rider could make it run. They were perhaps a half mile away, moving in a direction that would converge with James's course a little farther on, near a patch of woods. A couple of hundred yards behind the rider, three more horsemen were in pursuit. James could make out no details. They were only dark silhouettes, but he guessed that the three were Mexican cavalrymen.
Yeah!
Perhaps he could help the fugitive. In any case, it was only a question of time before the three soldiers saw him and made him a target, for he was in the open. He reached the little patch of timber ahead of the lone horseman. He waved his hat to get the man's attention. Two of them, given cover of the small wood, ought to be able to discourage three soldiers caught without cover. The soldiers saw him, too. One of them pulled his mount to a quick stop, dropped to the ground, and fired at the fleeing lone Texan. The horse stumbled and went rolling. James feared for a moment that the man was down to stay, but the Texan scrambled to his feet and came running, rifle in his hand. James braced his own rifle against the trunk of a tree and aimed at the nearest of the three pursuing horsemen. The man jerked, then fell out of the saddle and sprawled in the old brown grass. The other two reined up quickly, circling back to see about their comrade. During those brief moments, the fugitive reached James in the edge of the timber. He wore a month's ragged growth of whiskers, and his clothes were muddy from the fall, but he looked great to James. This was the first person he had seen in weeks other than Mexican soldiers. The man dropped to his knee and brought up his rifle while James quickly reloaded his own. The downed soldier's riderless horse ran in a frightened circle, then discovered James's sorrel tied at the edge of the wood and came toward it at a fast trot.
Friend, you look prettier to me than a whole room full of blushing young ladies. Oh, my horse was giving out on me and I was calling to the Lord something fierce. I reckon he must have heard me holler.
James nodded toward the soldier's black horse, which had come up to the tied sorrel.
Looks like he sent you a fresh mount, too. You must be in pretty good standing with him.
Well, I doubt that, but I made him a lot of promises that'd be damn hard to keep.
He shoved out his hand.
Well, name's Dick Johnson. I was out scouting for Mexicans.
James Lewis, looks like you found them all right.
Lewis, that beard covers your face, but your eyes remind me of a Lewis I knew one time over in Nacogdoches. Andrew, his name was.
My brother.
Him, me, and some others, we had us a scrap with a bunch that called themselves the Fredonians. You looked like you was ripped out of that same cloth. I'm mighty glad it was you I ran into.
James eased over to catch the Mexican horse and tie him securely.
How come you to be out this-a-way?
James told him, leaving out a lot of unnecessary details.
You're the first man I've talked to since I left that patrol down close to the Rio Grande. I've got no idea what's been happening.
You don't know about the Alamo or Goliad?
No.
James was saddened and angered by the melancholy events as Johnson related them in a strained voice. He remembered the Battle of Velasco, fought for Travis and others after they had already been released from Mexican custody. Now, Travis was dead, and Bowie, and all the rest. And Fannin at Goliad, where James had gone first in his search for Michael. So many men, such a terrible loss. Its magnitude was staggering. The two Mexican soldiers acted for a while as if they contemplated charging the two Texans, but they gave up and rode westward.
They'll be fetching help to get us more than likely. I'd as soon disappoint them, though.
Dick had no problems mounting the soldier's horse. The two men quickly began their eastward journey.
So is there any kind of Texan army left?
Well, Sam Houston was putting one together over at Gonzales. He's been retreating to the east lately, staying ahead of Santa Ana. Some of the boys are afraid he'll retreat plumb into Louisiana. But I think old Sam is just looking for the right place. When he finds it, he'll turn around and we'll give Santa Ana the worst case of snake bite he ever had. We could use a fight in Lewis. You want to join my outfit?
James studied on it a little. A few years ago, he would have been eager. Now, he had seen enough fighting to sicken him.
I'd like to find my family first and be sure they're safe.
Johnson pointed northeastward.
They'll be that way more than likely. There's been thousands of them pushing through the mud trying to get over to Louisiana. In wagons, carts, horseback, afoot. Houston's been keeping himself between them and the Mexicans to give them time. There's so many of them, you're apt to have trouble finding your own.
They came to a parting after a while. Johnson rode toward a rendezvous with his company. James followed the track of the refugees. It was plainer now, for they had been funneling together in a bigger and broader mass. Wheels had left deep scars in the rain-softened ground. James could imagine that much of the time the people had been pushing by hand, having to help the teams move their wagons and carts through the black mud. In places, the sorrel sank almost to its knees in the muck. He finally began overtaking refugees, some in wagons, some in spoke-wheeled carts. Some using the solid-wheeled Mexican-style carts that groaned and squealed like something out of a nightmare as wood rubbed against wood. Some vehicles were drawn by horses and mules, some by oxen. He passed a woman pushing a small handcart, her mud-spattered children following behind her, leading a milk cow. Almost without exception, the people he passed asked him how far behind the Mexicans were. Their anxiety became his anxiety, for he feared that some of them would be overtaken if nothing happened to halt the Santanista advance. Enemy patrols like the one he and Johnson had encountered could not be far in the rear. He came eventually to a broad plain where it appeared that hundreds of families had come together in a miserable, sodden encampment. Inquiry revealed that they were waiting for a ferry, which could take but a few at a time. Some had already been here several days, awaiting their turn. He inquired about the Lewises, but nobody seemed to know. He found a great deal of sickness, not just among children, but adults as well. For the flight from the Mexican advance had been arduous and mean, wet and cold, unmercifully wearing on everyone who had made it. He found one family burying a child in a muddy grave, a victim of typhoid. There were more, the grieving parents said. He came after a while to a familiar face, that of Marcus Caldwell. The farmer didn't recognize James until James told him who he was. The rusty-haired farmer was not the same contented, smiling man James had known before. He was haggard and drawn, his eyes dulled with pain.
We lost our littlest one. He was already ailing when the word came that we better pack up and get out. The rain and cold were too much for him. We buried him back yonder 2 days ago. We marked the grave, but I don't know if we can ever find it again. All that rain.
I'm awfully sorry.
James put his hand on the man's trembling shoulder.
Which way's your wagon? I'll go speak to your missus.
Caldwell went with him. Mrs. Caldwell was dull-eyed like her husband. James suspected she was sick herself. She spoke to him, but she seemed withdrawn, off in some distant place of her own. James suspected he knew where that was. Red-haired Libby Caldwell had no insults for James this time. She watched him with sad eyes that reflected the ordeal she had endured. She had seemed but a girl when he had last seen her. She was a woman now, matured before her time. He felt helpless in the face of all this trouble. He couldn't think of a thing he could do to lessen this family's tragedy, to ease the misery in which they found themselves.
I'm sorry.
Libby nodded an acknowledgement.
You don't look like you've had it easy yourself.
James told her briefly what he'd been through, what he had seen.
If I can find my family and be sure they're all right, I'll go join up with Houston's army.
You don't really think they can whip Santa Anna and all his soldiers, do you?
Maybe we can keep them fought back till everybody here has crossed to safe ground. Then we can follow.
But we'll lose Texas.
James nodded regretfully. That thought was bitter.
You take care of yourself, James Lewis. Maybe we'll meet again sometime. Somewhere.
I'd hope so.
He looked back over his shoulder a couple of times as he left her.